Welcome back to Word and Table, a weekly podcast on liturgy, sacrament, and the great tradition of Christian worship and why it is vital in our world today. I'm your host, Alex Wilgus, and I'm here as always with Father Stephen Gauthier. Welcome back, Father Stephen.
Great to be back, Father Alex.
Father Stephen is the canon theologian of the Diocese of the Upper Midwest in the Anglican Church in North America, and he is director of formation at St. Paul's House of Formation in the Greenhouse Movement. Father Stephen, you know, we've talked a lot on this program about how the early Christians faced persecution in the early years of the church's life. And we've gone over some of them. We've gone over the nature of those persecutions, how they were sort of sometimes more sporadic than official, but sometimes became official. But sometimes in Christian literature, you will hear about 10 specific persecutions being mentioned. So I wanted to talk about that, these 10 persecutions. What are those? Why single out 10? What's the importance of the number 10? So maybe you could tell us what these persecutions are and what the Christian authors are referring to when they talk of the 10 persecutions.
That's right. We have talked about why Christians were unpopular, for example, an episode on that, you know, why they were not always looked upon favorably by their neighbors. And there were persecutions. And we talked about some was just sporadic mob activity. It's like the trouble of a Jew living in Eastern Europe in late 19th century. You know, sometimes you just have a mob. You know, something would happen locally and people get upset. This would often happen after natural disasters. You know, they're very localized. But sometimes we actually had official actions of the imperial government. And that's what we talk about with the 10 great persecutions. And where we hear more about it is St. Augustine in the City of God actually talks about the 10 persecutions. He lists them and tells them why people were emphasizing the number 10. So 10 is significant because remember in the book of Revelations, it says in Revelation 17, verses 12 through 14, and the 10 horns that you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour, together with the beast. These are of one mind, and they hand over their power and authority to the beast. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for he is the Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with whom are called and chosen and faithful. So we have there the prophecy of 10 kings, you know, persecuting the church, making war on the Lamb. And their argument was that those 10 persecutions that we talk about in the book of Revelations were actually, this is at the end of the 4th century, around there, there are a number of people arguing that they actually represented the 10 specific persecutions the church had undergone before the church came above ground. And Augustine personally was not persuaded by this argument, by the way. Oh, I should mention that some people said, you know what really proves it scripturally? As you know, there was a foreshadowing. There were 10 plagues in Egypt. So the 10 plagues in Egypt, you know, were somehow foreshadowing these 10 kings who are actually these 10 persecutions. Augustine tells us all about this, but didn't buy it. He said, first of all, he thought the identification of 10 specific persecutions was pretty arbitrary. Why 10? You know, there are a lot of different things we could call imperial persecutions. How did you come up with a number 10 if you weren't looking for it? It's not something that's obvious, given the number of how you could divide things. And he also argued that, you know, you can actually see this in different lists. Not everybody had the same persecutions for the great 10. And so Augustine basically thought, he said, I think it's more speculation than exegesis. He said, who knows? I'm not saying they're wrong, but he's saying, I don't think there's any evidence for it. But it's really the nature of speculation. It's not something proof that is at all proven. So that's how we get the number of the 10 great persecutions, but it became very traditional. To this day, people still talk about the 10 persecutions.
Okay, yeah. So whether it's sort of scripturally foreshadowed or not, it's helpful to have a, you know, kind of an anchor point to be able to string together these events in history. So what are they? What are the 10? And why are they selected?
Well, they were associated with Roman emperors. Of course, we have Nero at the top of the list, followed by Domitian and Trajan, and Marcus Aurelius, also known as Antoninus, Septimus Severus, Maximinus, Decius, Valerian, Aurelian, and Diocletian and Maximin. So those were the 10 that he lists, that people have on lists. These are the 10 great persecutions.
Okay, so were all of these, these are all associated with different emperors, but were they all, you know, initiated by these emperors, or they just happened under their rule? Right. This fire was very convenient for him. Okay, so first we have Nero, but then we wait another 25, 28 years or so for the next one, right? Okay, so this is kind of more of a social thing, but it involves an actual kind of religious act that Christians just can't participate in. So they're like, okay, well, if you can't participate in those things, then we just can't trust you. Sure. We're not asking for much here. Yeah.
Then we have Trajan, about 106 to 117, and he's great because there's a governor, a great Roman writer, Pliny the Younger, okay? And Pliny the Younger wrote wonderful letters. In one of the letters, he writes to the Emperor Trajan. He's a governor out there, and he says, "You got to tell me what I do with this Christian thing. What's the appropriate way to handle this Christian group that we have out here?" And he gets a letter back from Trajan, and this sets the general policy. We have this document. So he says, basically, leave them alone. Don't go looking for trouble. Don't go looking out, hunting Christians down. However, if somebody comes and says, hey, this person is a Christian, they should be punished because this is, you know, sort of a secret group, etc. It doesn't seem good to the empire. This is too, remember, Christians meet secretly, all these kind of things. So they should be denounced. If they're denounced, if somebody says, hey, that person's a Christian, the Christian should be punished. However, there could be no anonymous denunciations. You can imagine what happens when somebody could just put it out there. I don't want to tell my name. You know, a concerned Roman that I think so-and-so. They have to sign their name, so to speak, which would subject them to perjury and things. So they would have to be willing to actually have their, to give their name and things. And where the persecution really starts, though, is he has a great victory over the Scythians and the Dacians. These are people out towards European Turkey and out in the north side of the Black Sea. And he has a great victory, and he comes back, and they have big victory celebrations, sort of like a VE Day type of thing. And Christians won't take part in the public service of Thanksgiving. You thank the gods for giving you victory in war. And that really irritated people. You know, how it seems disloyal. You have a national thing here. We do what we always do.
Whose side are you on? Yeah.
Yeah, it makes you suspicious. Why won't you join in things that are part of being a good Roman? And he passes a law, or not passes, he gives out a law against secret assemblies. This is what first forced Christians into the catacombs. Because, you know, they'd meet in houses and things, large houses and the like. But, you know, here, it's no longer, so he basically says you can't have public worship, so we have to make sure we still want to get together, but we can't do it in a way we'll be seen. And this is where we first start at the very beginning of the second century, with people actually meeting in the catacombs.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So this thing is similar to Domitian's. Like, we just kind of have to curb or curtail the opportunity for like seditious or antisocial behavior to grow among these people.
That's right. Matter of fact, in the letter that Pliny writes to Trajan, he says, you know, I understand that, you know, if for no other reason, people, even if they didn't commit a crime as such, their simple refusal to obey is a crime. I mean, he said, you know, what about people saying, because sometimes people accuse Christians of, eating babies and these kind of things. And he said, even in the absence of a crime, he said, I've got to admit, there's something wrong with people who refuse to follow a duly enunciated public order.
So that's under Trajan.
And then we have Hadrian. He's not on Augustine's list, but he's on other people's lists, some other people's lists. I wanted to mention him in passing. He fits in here nicely. What he did is basically he continues Trajan's policy, but frankly, it sputters out. It's very localized and sporadic. Maybe that's why he's not on Augustine's list. It's not very universal. It just sort of happens hither and yon.
So it seems like Trajan and Hadrian are not really particularly animated by stamping out this Christian thing. They're just trying to kind of curb it.
Yeah, just keep things in order. Now, Marcus Aurelius is different. Marcus Aurelius is a great philosopher. But he issues, in the very first year of his reign, he issues a decree against Christians. And this, most of the actual persecution was where it took place was pretty solid, was in the city of Rome itself, in Asia Minor, and in Gaul, what we now call southern France. And we know some of the people we know from Word and Table that we've talked about, people like Polycarp of Smyrna. Remember, he was someone who had actually known as a child, had known the Apostle John. You know, Polycarp of Smyrna is actually, they try to burn him alive. That doesn't actually work. He's actually eventually slain with a sword. But nonetheless, he's a very, we have the story of his martyrdom. We talked about it in an episode. Justin Martyr, he's a very important person. He was a philosopher who became a Christian. And he set up a school of Christian philosophy in Rome. And he was actually turned in by a professional rival. Okay, but Justin Martyr is one who tells us a lot about the early Roman church. When we ask, gee, what was the Eucharist like? What were baptisms like in the Church of Rome in the middle of the second century? He's the guy to turn to. He's the one who gives us. I'll still quote him to this day. Here's what a Eucharist looked like. Then we had a big persecution in Lyon. Lyon was the capital of Provincia, what we now call Provence, southern Gaul. And we have the bishop there, Pothinus, and also there's a young girl, 14 or so, called Blandina. And they die in the persecution. Don't do 40 other people, are killed there at Lyon. So there are many others, but those are the ones we would know from things we've mentioned, I think, in Word and Table.
So with Marcus Aurelius, though, you were saying this is a little bit more intentional. This is more muscular. So what was Marcus Aurelius's problem with Christians? Was it the same old thing, or was he more concerned about this than others?
Well, he seems to be more genuinely concerned. Maybe it's because maybe he thought some of the health of the Roman Empire. He is a philosopher of real note. I mean, his writings are excellent to read. One of the complaints was that Christians were sort of rotting out the philosophical moral fabric of Roman culture. And he's a serious philosopher, so he might have resented what he considers superstition.
So this is a little bit more reactionary. It's less just governing and more actually kind of ideologically reactionary.
But also we have a problem. Remember, while this is all going on, Christianity is really spreading. Early on it was just a sect. The Scientology of its day to some people. Okay. But imagine if you start having this really growing. And growing, and more important people becoming Christians. Not just riffraff, as the Romans would see it. More and more really important people are looking at this. I think you think this is something we have to deal with.
So that's Marcus Aurelius. He's obviously, he's a big name.
Yes. And again, his writings are brilliant. It's really a shame. You're sort of shocked when you see the quality of his writing, his reflections and things, his meditations. And then see what he did. But again, I think it might be the flip side of saying, this is the right way and being. But also, again, Christianity is really spreading.
Right.
By this time, there's no question this is not going away.
Mm-hmm. Well, that gets us through the second century. So what about the third century? We've had 5 of the 10 persecutions. Yeah, that sounds a lot like some closed Muslim countries today. That's their strategy, yeah. That's right. We do a thing at we have an All Hallows Eve festival, and we honor certain martyrs, and they're one of them. Yeah, yeah, it's a really beautiful account.
And then we have Maximinus Thrax, and that really means someone from Thrace. And at that time, that was basically, think of European Turkey, that little part there, that's Thrace. And that's where he comes from. And here we're getting, 235, 238 is the heart. And his idea was, how we'd get rid of the problem. Because a lot of people, like what would happen later on in England with the persecution under Queen Mary, is people felt, well, big fish would get caught in this stuff. Well, they're sort of playing, play foolish games, win foolish prizes, would be the view. But people really sympathize with little people who got caught up in stuff. So he says, the real thing is we should focus on church leadership. Take out their priests, their bishops, and things like that. Instead of focusing on little people, would be a more effective way to basically behead the church.
Yeah, so this is like the decapitation strategy. Like if you
exactly.
Knock off the head, then the limbs will follow.
And it really hurt. And one of the people who fell at that time was Hippolytus of Rome. And again, I'm just focusing on people we know from Word and Table. Hippolytus, of course, is the one where we talk about his Eucharistic prayer. Classically what we have with the Renewed Ancient Liturgy. is basically Model N and a few other prayers, but that's really one of the earliest Western Eucharistic prayers, and many of the revised ones in the late 20th century come from going back to him and looking at a few other prayers from that time. Well, let's make Rome great again. Why I'm saying this is as we reach Decius, the Emperor Decius, in 249, 251 AD, we are coming up with basically the 1,000th anniversary of the founding of Rome. Okay, so this is an exciting time, 1,000 years, but it's a very bad time politically. There are a lot of wars on the frontiers. A lot of things are going wrong on the frontiers and things. And people are complaining that this is because of Christians. Because Christians is part of the propaganda thing. It's like in the Old Testament, they mock the pagan gods. Christians would go around promoting Christianity by talking about how silly paganism was. Look at those stories, you know, look at their morality, look at what the gods do, etc. And so a lot of people are saying this is the revenge of the gods. You know, the gods are saying, you don't honor us anymore. You allow people to mock us. And we're trying to celebrate being Roman. You know, the real way is let's get back to our roots. Let's make Rome great again. So what they have is they instituted the first emperor-wide mandatory persecution involving every citizen. They're saying that every citizen would be required to either offer a sacrifice to the Roman gods, or they could get it, and they'd get a certificate called Libellus, means a little book. And that would be your proof that you'd done it. Okay. Now, the temptation was, of course, for some people would actually, you know, because most people didn't want to see, you know, they said, look, what's the harm? Just throw a bit of incense, you know, we're home, you know, no harm, no foul. And other people say, if you don't even want to do that, look, in the Roman Empire, you can buy anything. It is corrupt. I mean, your officials are corrupt. And so basically saying, look, pay us some money and we'll give you a certificate. You don't have to actually do anything. But people say that's still a scandal. To say you've done something gives the same scandals if you actually did. So this really becomes hard. People actually have to start worrying, what am I going to do? Notable victims are Fabian, one of the popes at Rome, a very good figure. Origen himself, he wasn't killed, but he was tortured and imprisoned. Okay, and this is where we get some of our earliest hermits in Egypt, where it was very practical to do so. A number of people just leave and go into the desert until things calm down. You know, it's time to get out of town. So we have some of the earliest hermits come from this time of Decius. But again, there was, and we're going to see a lot more of that when Augustine talks about people blaming the bad things as the empire begins going downhill, saying, you know, when we honored the gods, this stuff didn't happen. And so that's one of the reasons Augustine started writing The City of God, was to say, that's not true. You have it exactly backwards. Yeah, it would be that anyone could simply say, well, just show your papers. You know, it's hard in an empire like this, but somebody could say, just show your papers. And if you didn't have them, you were in trouble. And then we have Valerian. He's 257, 260. And he goes even farther. He really follows in the footsteps of Decius, but he also says, we got to focus more than ever on the clergy. You got to decapitate it. Cut off the head of the snake, as they would have put it. And at first that meant banishing at the very early stage, but later it meant beheading. It was basically automatic upon identification as a priest or a deacon, for example. You were automatic. We actually see a very famous case of this with Sixtus of Rome and the great martyr Lawrence. They were caught secretly worshiping, and they were beheaded on the spot. The law said the simple identification as a Christian priest or bishop meant automatic execution on the spot. Okay, originally started with banishing, get rid of it, saying, they kill them. And also, there are a lot of upper-class converts, and normally money could get you anything, but this time they're saying, we're going to basically, if we find out that you're a Christian, we're going to seize all your assets, we're going to take your stuff. And they said, you know, we're on to this using the catacombs. Simply showing up at the catacombs was a crime. And that's how we got Sixtus and Lawrence, because they were actually having a Eucharist in a catacomb, and they were caught while they're having Eucharist. And so they said, you can't even visit them. So you don't even say, oh, well, you didn't catch us actually in the act. And yeah, why are you here?
Yeah.
Do you like hanging out in tombs, among the tombs? Okay. And so again, famous people are Stephen of Rome, Stephen the First, if you don't remember, we talked about him. He was the pen pal, so to speak, of Cyprian of Carthage.
That's right. That's
remember
right.
They talked about the guy. He was their pen pal. They were friends. And so both he and Cyprian, both of them die in this persecution, one in North Africa, one here. And Sixtus and Lawrence again. Sixtus, the bishop of Rome, and Lawrence, the great, the deacon, who is famously burned alive.
And so this is the persecution, right, where after Dacius, right, certain people who kind of chickened out got a second chance, as it were, right? Or like...
Right, that really caused us a lot of grief, because with Dacius, we exactly had the first problems of what do we do with people who chickened out? And which was, by the way, what the Romans wanted. The Romans didn't want to kill anybody. They're basically, we're going to do this because we just get you to do the, quote, right thing. And they'd even have the requirement of the Roman citizens, you had automatically 3 days to get into your right mind, to think it out. Meanwhile, you hear people screaming and things. The idea is we want you to come back to your right, to your senses and be a good Roman again. But it worked with a lot of people, and then they repented. And then the question is, do we or do we not accept them back into the church is going to be the problem.
Wasn't there some question about Cyprian's own fortitude, right? Because he didn't get pinched in Decius' persecution, but then later with Valerian, that's where he kind of gets his moment, isn't that right?
That's right. But to be fair to him, the argument is what you do. They wanted to decapitate the church, and so he had a lot of people to take care of. And their argument is, why don't you go? They had a safe spot for him where he could go. A very comfortable spot. You know, it's on the coast and things. But the point was he'd be out of harm's way.
Yeah.
And that he could continue to run the church indirectly.
Right.
But a lot of people thought he had chickened out. And so he said, I'll prove it to you. Because when the persecution opens again, he actually shows up, you know, in town. Here I am. But he always denied and that in any way he had chickened out. He's saying, I just thought the best thing to do for the church was we need to keep enough of an infrastructure up there so we could keep the church moving, keep the church leadership going.
So the next one is Aurelian, right? Not to be confused
yes.
with Aurelius, but Aurelian.
Yeah, and he has the idea, again, they're trying to find some unifying principle. So what about the unconquered son, the Sol Invictus? So he tries to create sort of a new cult and things, and it's very unified, the son is single, etc. He would really like to completely get rid of Christianity. By the way, the Sol Invictus was to be celebrated at the, basically at the winter solstice, you know, basically the 25th
right.
of December, as they saw it. And but he actually was assassinated only 8 months after the persecution started. It had nothing to do with the persecution. He just had other enemies. So it didn't last very long under him.
Okay, I see. The unconquered son, the Sol Invictus thing, that was kind of this was another sort of resourcing something in the tradition to try and kind of like make Rome great again,
yeah.
right? Like a kind of a new vision statement, I guess.
Exactly, a new way, exactly. Yeah. Remember, we had a revolution like this in Egypt. Remember the Hyksos, who were sun worshippers, this united... got into that kind of thing. He's hoping something like this might be helpful. It wasn't.
Yeah, it didn't work so well.
Didn't take off.
Okay.
And then in 303 to 305, we have the persecution of persecutions, Diocletian. And actually, we should give credit to his partner, Maximin, as well. Okay, but Diocletian, we call it the Diocletian's persecution. Otherwise, Diocletian was an excellent emperor, except for, you know, it's like a burglar's an honest man, you know, 23 hours a day. But, I mean, except for this, he was actually quite in his right mind and things and a pretty good emperor. But he, for the first 14 years of his reign, he allowed freedom of worship. But then he started saying, you know, part of fixing the empire, because the empire, things are getting worse and worse as time passes on, is that we need to do, first of all, we need security, so we need to get Christians out of the armed forces. So right before the big persecution starts, if you're a Christian, your armed forces, you are required to resign. You resign from the army, which is always a career. There wasn't a small thing. It's 20 years. Okay. Then begins in 303. There are four decrees that become the great, what Christians came to know as the great persecution. And he decreed, first of all, that churches, actually there have been some church buildings in place and things, and scriptures had to be destroyed. You know, you're ordered, churches had to be torn down, any structures, and scriptures had to be turned over to the government and destroyed. He ordered any clergy to be imprisoned. And what's really deadly, they became outlaws in the actual sense of that term, loss of civil rights, meaning you had nowhere to go if you had if somebody took advantage of you. You couldn't go to courts. You had lost standing in a court. So if somebody robbed you or something, you couldn't get any help from the government. You know, you had no standing. You lost your civil rights. You had no standing in a court. And he said all citizens required to offer sacrifice to the gods or face execution. A whole lot of people fell under this. Many of the early saints that we haven't talked about, like, you know, Lucy, Agatha, people like that, died at this time. We'll have to talk about them in future episodes. One person important to us is the first British martyr died under this persecution. Alban, A-L-B-A-N. Saint Alban died during the persecution of Diocletian. And we actually have a coin that he minted. This is a ceremony, not regular money. They like ceremonial coins, like you sometimes have, like mints put out these coins. And it had written on it, Diocletian Emperor destroyed the Christian name.
Hmm. Wow.
He wished.
Yeah.
It didn't work that way.
Got minted a little too soon.
A little too soon, because actually, the reason it got so bad, it's darkest before the dawn, is things were getting desperate because you need to have, frankly, I think the best way to look at what's going to happen in the next step will be what ends the persecutions, is the whole function of religion as opposed to philosophy in the Roman world, you know, was considered by the educated was to create an infrastructure of public ceremonial, you know, of public culture. And if it couldn't be shared, it was to unite people.
Yeah.
We could all get together and be united. Now, their ideal would have been we could have all done this under what we call neo-paganism, sort of a cleaned-up paganism. Hmm. And we tried that even later. There's a quick thing of somebody called Julian the Apostate in the 4th century. That doesn't work. It doesn't work at all. But it just doesn't work, and so basically you can't beat him, join him. Constantine thinks clearly he has a conversion experience, but clearly one thing that helps is realizing, you know, have we ever thought of people convert to Christianity, never convert to paganism. It's a one-way street.
Right.
So maybe our answer is to jump on the Christian train. And that's going to lead to the Edict of Milan in 313, which actually makes Christianity simply legal. It makes an official legal religion of the empire. But things become so overwhelming that later on, I think like 386 or so, we actually have Theodosius I issues an edict, the Edict of Thessalonica, which makes Nicene Christianity the state religion of the emperor and actually closes all pagan worship.
Yeah.
They close the temples, stop sacrifices. Okay. So that's the story of the 10 great persecutions. One thing that's interesting, remember those people who thought it was so important to tie to Revelation? Well, one of the reasons they wanted to do that, we're told by Augustine, is that their view is, well, that's all behind us now. It's a Christian empire. And the only persecution that ever happened again, some of these people thought, would be when the Antichrist came. You know, at the very end of time, there'd be one last assault. But this was the end of persecutions, those 10. And then there'd be this. So that was sort of attractive to some people.
Okay. So those are the 10 then. So when, like you say, spectacular failures, each one of them, possible contributors to the empire becoming Christian by the time Constantine tolerates Christianity, and then on to Theodosius's edicts, which is really dramatic reversal, making Christianity the official religion. So you probably wouldn't have thought this.
Well, that'd be by Theodosius, right? But under Constantine, for all practical purposes, that's the case. But still, officially, there it's a pagan empire. You know, you still have the altar to victory in the Senate chamber and the Curia, etc. But
yeah,
no, it's all over. And there's a real lesson for us, you know, despite all these persecutions. Is remember the Christianity kept growing. Mm-hmm. In spite of all this, Christianity was growing on the ground. That's where real growth was happening. It was on the top. It was on the ground that it was growing. And finally, it was its simple weight. It became so powerful that really put an end. That's how they really beat their enemies.
Yeah, so it's really just facts on the ground here.
And because they really had what people were looking for, is paganism had run its course. And the, so what do we do? And, Christianity offered the truth of God, but they offered a real answer to the need people felt for what's the truth about God and faith. It had a real answer that people found very satisfying. people who weren't philosophers. And also Christianity lent itself very much for people with a philosophical bent, because Christianity and Platonism were very friendly.
Thank you, Father Stephen. Thank you for listening to Word and Table. We will be back again next week for more on liturgy, sacrament, and the great tradition of Christian worship.